Naughty, naughty boy.
But a good neuroscientist is going to tell us the truth. And he's a good friend of mine, and we've known each other a while now, and he's come here in the past to speak and has picked up, and I'm very happy to say, connected in some real sense, the theoretical work that I've done a bit on narrative practice hypothesis, connected up with views about autism, tried to help make better sense of them and connect that those issues with the neuroscience. And he has a range of interests which I think makes him much more exciting than your everyday neuroscientist. He has an understanding of literary theory, he has an interest in philosophy, and he has an interest in connecting this first-hand understanding of autism as well. So I can't think of no one better to actually take us through this kind of issue and connect, show us what the connection is between neural and narrative connectivity in autism. And it's going to take us from theory to therapy. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that express and very flattering introduction. Actually, much more flattering than the usual things a scientist say. Oh, he received his PhD from blah, 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 and he did his postdoc.
It's more personal narrative here.
Exactly. Okay, so first of all, and you know, this is going to be one of those do as I say and not as I do moments. We're going to start with a little exercise in social imitation. You're going to watch what I'm doing, and your mirror neurons are going to fire, and then you are going to do it too, right? It's the off switch. Okay. So I want to tell you about autism physiology, and also about how that physiology relates to a psychological understanding of autism. And there are aspects of autism that are best understood at one or the other of those levels. People often mistake them for each other. In particular, we can map neural connectivity in autism and neural disconnectivity in autism to narrative disconnectivity. And I want to use the first part of the talk to tell you about some physiological results underlying that relationship. And then the second part of the talk to inquire, okay, well, what does this actually mean for therapy? Okay, now, which one of these people is autistic?
None of them.
None of them?
No. The mother.
Okay, well.
Can you see them move?
Sorry?
Can you see them move?
No, you don't need to see them move. Actually, it may be even better in the still photo, because
the screw to the left. The one on the tricycle, I think. Okay.
Sure. Now, what tells you that? What things? What aspects? The posture, right? Okay, that's one thing.
It's no eye contact.
No eye contact, or at least no eye contact with the other people.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So those are two big things. Now notice that one of them actually is reflective of diagnostic criteria for autism. All the diagnostic criteria talk about social and affective contact, and gaze contact, of course, is one aspect of that. But the diagnostic criteria for autism, if you open the DSM-4 and you look, they say absolutely nothing about postural control, motor aspects, any of this stuff. These two actually may be two aspects, two sides of the same coin. But because our society is based on social capacity and social affective relationship, we define autism in terms of what we feel is absent. So it's the social piece that's missing. And according to the DSM-4, the motor issues are ancillary. Now, is that a feature of autism, or is that a feature of psychiatrists? Okay. Well, if you do read the DSM-4 and you look at the diagnostic features of autism, you see that there are three main and not entirely mutually exclusive areas: social interaction, communication, and what are called restricted and repetitive interests and behaviors. And in the interest of time, I just want to zero in on one of those areas, the area of social interaction. I've underscored certain terms here to try to develop a theme to what may be going on. So nonverbal communication, poor coordination of gaze and expression and gesture. Now let's examine what that means. Okay, so I'm standing here speaking to you. I have information in my brain that I am trying to duplicate in your brains. And I am sending that information out on several channels. Now, if you had a transcript of this talk, you could get most of the information out of it. If you had a verbatim transcript, word for word, everything I said, you could derive most of what I'm saying. Would you have all of it just from the transcript?
No.
No. Why not?
Because you are communicating.
Yeah?
Using your body language.
Okay. Okay, so body language, so gesture. That's one channel of communication that I'm using. What other channels?
Your pitch.
My pitch, right? The affective modulation in my voice, absolutely. Prosody. Anything else?
Overheads.
Yeah. So I've got these visual aids, which in this case happens to be a piece of text, but okay.
Your engagement with the word.
Say more about that.
Well, if you're not engaged with what you're talking about, then we wouldn't get as much from it, and we won't get that just from reading.
Right.
From the way you present yourself here.
Right. So we were just talking about these conferences full of philosophers who, no offense, who philosophers, not Dan, who, I've just dug myself a deeper hole, haven't I? who go on just reading a paper in front of people, you know, without actually giving a talk based on the paper. Okay, so the point is, I am doing what in engineering terms would be called multiplexing my communication out onto these several simultaneous channels. I have an idea in my head, and I am sending it out in terms of words. I'm giving affective valence to those words in terms of my tone of voice. I'm making eye contact with people because I want to see whether or not they're receiving and understanding. I am gesturing, so on and so forth. All these channels are coming out of me simultaneously. And for me, and for most people, this is actually effortless. It's natural. In fact, you can't really stop yourself from doing it. If you try to speak about a subject that you care about using just a single channel, you find yourself, if you're talking on the phone, right, you find yourself, right? This is quite natural for most of us, but people with autism, it's one channel. You can attend to the words. If you do attend to the words, then you're not going to be attending to the prosody or to the gesture or to the eye contact. Or you can choose to attend to the prosody, and maybe you would pick up the emotional tone, but the words would go whoosh in one ear, out the other. So you have one channel. I am multiplexing my communication out onto several channels. I am expecting all of you to demultiplex that back into a single construct of meaning. But if you're autistic, you can't multiplex and you can't demultiplex. You can process one channel at a time, and you process that channel very intensely, very deeply, but in the absence of all context. Keep that in mind. Peer relationships. A lack of manifest interest in others. Response to social overtures and joining in social play. Now, why do I say manifest? I think perhaps the phenomenon that best illustrates this is what is called parallel play. Now, I know that a lot of people here in the audience work with people with autism, so I don't really have to explain parallel play to them. Does one of you want to explain it? Or I can. Yeah, okay.
I'm playing with something, and the autistic child over there playing.
Right. And they're going through the same motions, right? But there's that lack of interaction with the person, or actually more frequently, with the group of people, right? So you see a child on the edge of a playground, And there's a bunch of children, they're playing some kind of social game, and you'll see the autistic child watching and looking very intently, trying to derive the rules by which the game is operating. But the trouble is, social interactions, the rules change so quickly, and the actions go by so fast, that if you process slowly, and if you process, as we said, only one piece at a time, right, one channel at a time, and you take time to integrate those channels, well, by the time you've sorted out what is appropriate to do, the interaction has passed you by. So there is a popular myth that people with autism in general are not interested in social interaction. Now, that may be the case for some people in some instances at some times in some contexts, but it's not generally the case. There are people with autism who are highly interested in social interaction, but they can't sort out how to jump on to that rapidly moving train. And I'll tell you in a moment about some physiology that underlies that. Notice that this phenomenon of disrupted peer relationships, the lack of sort of coordination and simultaneity that underlies that, has a great deal to do with the impairment in nonverbal communication. Sharing of interest and enjoyment. Again, same theme, coordination. Difficulties coordinating attention, taking pleasure in others' enjoyment, seeking to share one's own enjoyment. If I have my perspective on something and I think this thing that I'm doing is really cool, I have a great deal of difficulty shifting from that egocentric perspective of mine to an allocentric perspective and thinking about how and whether a social partner might also think it really cool. Again, it's that shifting and coordinating between different stances or perspectives. Social and emotional reciprocity, same deal. Difficulty inhibiting socially inappropriate responses, something that you would do in one context but you would never dream of doing in another context, right? Something you would do when you're in the toilet that you wouldn't do when you're in a church, right? This can be difficult, contextualizing things. And this contextualization requires, again, integration of separate cognitive channels and activities. So the theme that I want you to try to extract from this is that all of these autistic differences are differences relating to the coordination of cognitive activities. And we're going to see in a moment that this coordination of cognitive activities has a lot to do with the coordination, the physiological coordination between separate brain regions. So what do we think underlies autism in general? Well, here is one hypothesis. Let's suppose that you have a brain whose local networks, that is very small scale neural networks, one neuron to a neighbor, right, are either very overconnected or very underconnected. And let me illustrate what I mean by that. Suppose this marker is a neuron, yeah? Okay? And this neuron can activate its neighbors by marking them. Okay? Now, so this dot will represent an activated neuron. Now let's suppose I take the cap off, I go away, I come back the next day, and I'm ready to use my neuron, right? And I'm all excited, and I touch the neuron to its neighbor across the synapse, and what happens? Huh? Absolutely nothing, right. Because my synapse is below threshold to be activated, I'm pathologically underconnected now. Okay, so I touch the marker of the board remains totally white. Now, the converse situation. Let's suppose I take some solvent, I don't know what they use in these things, alcohol or something, whatever it is. Well, let's suppose I pour extra solvent into the marker, right? Or some joker does it for me. And so this thing is now like full of this liquidy stuff that, you know, the moment you take the cap off, it gets all over your hand and your clothes. And so I take the cap off without thinking, and I touch it to the board, and what happens? Right. Yeah. The entire board becomes green. Now, in either of those cases, can I represent any information on the board? Right. So, in order to write something on the board, I need to be able to have contrast. Okay? I need some neurons to be activated, but I need some neurons to be inactivated. That's the way I use the board to represent information. Well, in that case, if we sort of graph a relationship between neural connectivity and what I'm going to call network entropy, which is a measure of information capacity, what we end up with is the classic pharmacological relationship, the inverted U. Right? So a pathologically underconnected network is not going to be able to represent much information. But at the same time, a pathologically overconnected network also is not going to be able to represent much information. You have to have a happy medium in which it is possible, with an appropriate signal, to activate a neuron, but a situation in which that activation does not spread to all of that neuron's neighbors indiscriminately. If it spreads to the neighbors indiscriminately, then maybe you have epilepsy, which in fact a lot of people with severe autism do. So here we have a graphic. Here's information coming in. It's activating some local set of neurons, but that activation is not spreading pathologically. And this generates a brain in which locally active regions develop activity-dependent connections with each other. If you have two regions widely separated, they're both doing correlated computations, they tend to develop long-range connections between each other. Not all of this is hard-coded into the genes. We only have 20 or 30,000 genes. That's not enough to build a brain. So what the genes do is kind of bootstrap the brain. They specify this stuff. How do you connect one neuron locally to another? And they also specify between two widely separated brain regions that happen to be implementing correlated computations, how do you grow a long-range connection? Okay, so the development of these long-range connections is contingent, then, upon proper information representation within local regions. If you bollocks up the local regions by having pathologically underconnected or overconnected activity, then you don't have proper information representation. If you don't have proper information representation, you don't have the development of long-range connections, because that depends upon proper activity. So, in the non-autistic case here, you end up with a brain with widely separated brain regions that can come together rapidly and flexibly to adapt to changing cognitive conditions. They can exploit those long-range connections that they've developed in order to reconfigure themselves almost instantaneously to new problem demands. In an autistic brain, what you have is a situation in which information comes in to a local patch of cortex. In this case, it's visual information in visual cortex here. It activates that cortex very, very strongly, but that activation does not spread to other regions of the brain. Now, these are actual scans taken from groups of non-autistic and autistic participants solving a visual attention problem. Their behavioral performance on the problem did not differ, but they solved it in extremely different ways because they have extremely different brains. The non-autistic brain is a highly integrated collection of semi-autonomous processors. The autistic brain is a very, very loosely integrated collection of almost entirely autonomous subprocessors. So This is behind what a lot of people with autism describe in their own narratives as a tendency to think in pictures. If you push all of computation down into the very earliest sensory and perceptual stages of computation, that's what you get. You don't think in terms of narrative so much as you think in terms of veridical sensory data. And we can see that in the physiology. This is visual cortex lighting up, and this is a network of parietal frontal regions lighting up in the non-autistic brain. Different people with autism tend to specialize, as it were, in different kinds of sensory processing. Most of them prefer vision, but there are those who have become specialists in auditory processing. So these are data from one subject who's become very good, actually, at typed communication. And we've shown here that for him, if he gets simultaneous sensory stimuli, auditory and visual, he will not see the visual stimulus. He'll just hear the auditory stimulus. Same time, if he gets auditory and tactile stimuli, he will not feel the tactile stimulus. He will only hear the auditory stimulus. He has become a specialist in one channel. And that's what works for him. If you had a brain that were disconnected in the same way that an autistic brain is, you too would become a sensory specialist, because that's the way you adapt to having a brain like that. Okay. We've already seen that. So how do you get this sort of pathological underconnectivity or pathological overconnectivity? What are the roots into it? I have a whole lecture I could give about that, but I don't have time for that. Let's just say there are many, 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 many ways that you can affect neural connectivity. There are many ways that you can affect any complex genetic trait. Take skin color, for instance, which comes in quite a range of shades and variations, and yet is still strongly genetic. So the analogy that I might draw is, you know, we're talking about some sort of end difference in the behavior of the system. We're talking about autistic behavior, which is underlain by abnormally low entropy neural networks. How do you get into that low entropy state? Well, this is the same as asking, suppose I have a car whose engine is overspeeding. What causes the engine to overspeed? Well, it could be different things in different cars. Could be maybe I've used the wrong viscosity of oil in the crankcase, and so the engine is turning too quickly, right? That's one thing. Maybe it's a problem with the rotor and points or the electronic ignition system. That could be another thing. Maybe it's a problem with the carburetor, where the fuel-air mixture is too rich, right? All these different biological causes feed in to the same behavior of the car. And the way that we have characterized autism as neurobiologists has been very damaging to the understanding of autism, because we characterize it as though it were a singular, indivisible syndrome. It's analogous to the automobile mechanics talking about, well, I know what causes a car's engine to overspeed. It's a problem with the carburetor and the fuel-air mixture is too rich. And see, here are these examples, and I've published 5 different papers and done 5 different experiments showing you that when I, you know, put my finger on the carburetor, the engine begins to overspeed. So clearly, this is what causes engine overspeeding, right? Now, that is probably good enough to get that particular mechanic tenure at that particular repair shop. But across town, there's another mechanic at another repair shop busily getting tenure at that repair shop, saying, no, that's all rubbish. I know exactly what causes an engine to overspeed. I have a specialized repair shop that designs experiments only in crankcase oil viscosity. I have done a series of 10 different experiments, published 10 different papers on crankcase oil viscosity. I can tell you exactly what viscosity causes that overspeeding. And it's oil viscosity. And so these two people are butting heads, right? this is the way the field of autism is right now. We're arguing about the details and the first causes without really perceiving the synthesis in the final common pathways of difference. The effect of this is that if you lump all people with autism together into your sample and you run a study of autism, you get one of these three graphs. May or may not have a difference in the mean, but you always have a huge variance in the autistic sample because you're lumping different biological conditions together into the same study. So what is the effect of all this? Here's a picture of what we scientists are doing about autism. Okay? Autism is the elephant in the room. Nobody talks about it. Instead, people talk about weak central coherence or disrupted executive function or disrupted theory of mind module, etc. What underlies all of those? What feeds into all of them? Well, we don't step back and get it. And I think it's highly, highly, highly ironic that having constructed such a weak, centrally coherent picture of autism research, we talk about people with autism as having weak central coherence. So one of the root problems here, if you buy this argument of mine that the autistic brain is functionally disconnected, has become a collection of mostly autonomous subprocessors, is a problem of simultaneous access to the central executive from many simultaneous processes going on. And people with autism, especially those with severe autism who can communicate slowly and effortfully, say that, well, look, you know, I can think the thought or I can think the words. I cannot do both at the same time. If I try to think the words, because remember, they're thinking in pictures. If I try to think the words, the thought goes away. So knowing and imagining simultaneously, representing, as we've heard from Thomas Fuchs and also this morning from Adam, self-representation and other representation simultaneously. It isn't that the capability to self-represent or the capability to represent others is in itself damaged. It's doing these two things at the same time and integrating them into a central executive process. Thinking and phrasing, the percept and the concept, two separate sensory channels like seeing and hearing, all of these things going on at the same time are problems. So that is a theme that begins to emerge from autistic cognition and behavior that maps, I think, fairly directly onto autistic neural connectivity. Okay, well, this is actually a fairly old slide now, but it describes the nature of attention when you have a brain that is this disconnected. So what we've done here is we've asked people with and without autism to, it's a very simple task, you see a light here, you need to respond to that light by shifting your attention over here and then pressing a button as rapidly as possible when a light here comes on. Okay? So there's a cue here, there's a target here, you need to attend to the cue. When the cue comes on, you need to shift over here, wait for the target. Got it? All right. So here is a graph of the success rate at detecting the target versus the number of milliseconds between the cue and the target. These are people without autism. These are people with autism. Now, what do you notice about this graph? What does the graph tell you? Well, they are, yeah, they are slow. How slow are they?
They just don't do it. They don't get it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, again, this is success rate. This is number of milliseconds since the cue to shift. Okay? So this is about 2 seconds right here. This is 1.5 seconds, 1.1, so on and so forth. So the question is, how slow are they? Is there a point at which they become typical in their responding? Yeah, okay. So if you give them a couple of seconds, they're up here, you know, fairly indistinguishable from non-autistic people. It's only when things begin to happen rapidly that that attentional shifting ability falls off. Now, think back to those DSM criteria, which are all about social communication. And think what we demand of people when we socially communicate with them. Now, it's not so bad when I'm giving a lecture to you or you're giving a lecture to me, right? Because it's somewhat interactive, but it's not highly interactive. And it's on a very constrained topic. I mean, you know that I'm going to be talking about autism, something about autism, right? But if we're going down to the tea break and we start having a conversation, it may or may not be about autism. It might be about something totally different. It might be about, how rubbish the rooms are and they smell of mold and so on and so forth. but point is, you don't know what topic is coming. And therefore, you haven't got time to prepare for that topic. It's also the case that if we're having a social conversation, it might not just be between you and me. It might be between three of us, or four, or five, or six. Suppose you've got a conversation between five people. Okay, so you and four others. You've got four different sources of information in space. Each of them using umpteen different communication channels. You know, words, tone of voice, gesture, eye contact, facial expression, all this stuff. Right? So you've got all these sources of information to shift between and to integrate. And it is generally not the case, if I'm having a conversation in a group of people, that I will raise my hand, wait 2 seconds for you to shift your attention, and then begin speaking. In fact, most of the information goes by in those golden 2 seconds. So you put a person whose brain is disconnected in this manner into a typical social communication scenario, and of course they're going to fall apart. Is that a social communication deficit? Is that a domain-specific cognitive deficit? Or is it a deficit in cognitive coordination in general as a result of a generalized pattern of brain disconnectivity? My claim, of course, is the latter. Okay, here's a very quick experiment. Here's all you have to do. You have to look at this cross, and you have to tell me whether simultaneously this stimulus is oriented this way, diagonally up, which it is not at the moment, right? And this stimulus is orange. Got it?
And what do we do then?
Oh, you have two buttons in front of you, and one is yes, one is no. Okay? So it's yes if this thing is going this way, and this is orange. Mm-hmm. But if either of those is not the case, then it's no.
It's got to be both orange and pointing that way. And then we say yes. One's not.
Both this one orange, but don't care about the orientation.
That's right.
And this one pointing this way, but don't care about the color. Okay? So what you have to do to solve this task is you have to integrate three separate channels of information. You have to integrate spatial position, orientation, and color. Now, we can make it harder if we put these up for only 167 milliseconds and then take them down again. In 167 milliseconds, you don't have time to make an eye movement. So you have to be looking straight at this cross and covertly distributing your attention between the two sides. Okay? And we can, in fact, make it even harder. How is that harder? Tell me. They're all different orientations or different colors. So these distractors have been spatially interposed between the two target locations, right? We don't care about any of this stuff, but they're in there and they distract us. So that makes it all the more necessary that we have to use spatial position of these stimuli as a disambiguating factor. Now we can make it easier again. How is that easier?
They're mostly in the right direction.
And
the center of focus.
Yeah. Focus crosses them.
Right, exactly. The spatially intervening stimuli are congruent with the two target stimuli, which are congruent with each other. So now we can collapse those dimensions of spatial position and orientation and color into a single object. All right, so that's the easy condition. That's the hard condition. And let's see what happens if we look at behavior. I won't dwell on this in the interest of time, but suffice it to say that higher on this axis is better performance. And we have people without autism, people with autism, and the clinically unaffected siblings of people with autism who are sort of smeared out right in the middle here. You often find that in unaffected siblings. And if I have time, I'll get back to that point. Okay, the physiology is what's really, really interesting. And in the interest of time, I just want you to look at this one panel, okay? Ignore everything else, just look at this one. Now, I'm putting these stimuli up for 167 milliseconds, but I am allowing 3 seconds for a response. Now, if you know anything about fMRI, you know it takes a few seconds for blood flow to reach the portions of the brain that are active, so we add in another 3 seconds for that blood flow response delay. Now, given that, what we should see in the areas that are active during this task is a response at about 6 seconds. That's 3 seconds for the decision period, and another 3 seconds for the blood flow response. You with me? Yeah? Okay. So each one of these marks, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, right? Each one of these marks is 2 seconds, and I've deliberately left these axes unlabeled so that we can have a little quiz. In this panel, which one of the traces, red, or magenta, or blue, is the typical controls, the people without autism, who are not related to anybody with autism? We have 3 groups. We have typical, we have unaffected siblings of people with autism, and we have people with autism themselves. Which one is the typical group?
Red.
Why?
Because they're good at the short times, and they get less good at the long times.
Okay. Well, it's not a question of good. It's
more success rate. Yeah.
Right. So, again, we were looking for a peak at 6 seconds. Okay. And we read out to 6 seconds, and there is the peak. Right? So you have a 3 second decision interval, and we have they're given 3 seconds to press the button. And we have 3 seconds for the blood flow response. So the region turns on, is active whilst it's needed, and then as soon as it isn't needed anymore, it switches off. Right? So those are the typicals. Okay, great. You're actually doing much, much better than most audiences do on this. Most audiences get the first question wrong. Okay, so that leaves us 2 groups now. We've got the magenta and the blue. Now, one of them is the unaffected siblings of people with autism, and the other is people with autism themselves. Which one is the people with autism?
It's COVID.
Yes.
That's it's a very good test-taking strategy. How many people think magenta? Yeah, how many people think blue? Okay, so the magentas have it, and actually, everybody who thought magenta, you're wrong. Well done. It's the blue curve that's the autistic curve. Now, let's look at that. They get to the same kind of peak that people without autism do, but they get there in about 10 seconds. Now, that's 4 seconds later. Now, at this point, they have only 3 seconds to press the button. Once that 3 seconds is up, that's it. Train has left the station. It's not coming back. This entire activation that they're doing is totally useless for the task at hand. And they know it. They can't stop it. It's this delayed, sort of sticky style of attention and cognitive organization. They get there, but they get there late. Now, that leaves the magenta as the siblings. I won't say much about that because this isn't really a talk about siblings, but suffice it to say that when the siblings get there, they have the same delay, but when they get there, they nail it, right? They really jack up that differential activation between the difficult and easy condition. And this might be, this efficiency of frontal lobe activation might be what is rescuing them from the autism phenotype. So they may have the same local network abnormality that the people with autism have, something that runs in autism families, and yet this has not developed into the same long-range disconnectivity. I'll point out one other thing on this slide. Down here, right interparietal sulcus, this is a visual area, and you can see that the typical controls don't even bother to use it. They don't need it. All the computations that they're doing are going on in frontal lobe. So they never switch it on. The people with autism, it's the first thing they switch on. Before anything else, before all this frontal lobe stuff gets going, visual cortex is active in response to the stimulus. And then when frontal lobe finally wakes up and switches on, it sends a top-down control signal to visual cortex. Visual cortex is already on top of the game, right? Visual cortex has already woken up and processed the stimulus. But meanwhile, frontal cortex finally wakes up to, oh, right, something coming in. Yeah, visual cortex, can you get on that? And visual cortex, yeah, dude, I was on that. Here it is again. So, simultaneous with this frontal cortex bump, you get this visual cortex second bump. Interestingly, the siblings don't have that pronounced early bump in visual cortex, but they do have that second top-down frontal hump. Right. Okay, so that's all I'll say about that. If we compare levels of functional integration in autistic and non-autistic brains, what we've done, we've listed 76 brain regions down this axis and down this axis. Okay? And we just asked the question, is the fMRI time series, the pattern, the temporal pattern of blood flow in each of these regions, similar? All right. So in a region pair, if I read off the column for one region and the row for another, okay, each of these little squares represents a region pair, and I've set a colored dot there if the fMRI time series in those regions are significantly correlated. Now, what do you notice about these pictures? This is typical, this is autism, and this is autism SIBS. Who's different? Who's the same?
Yeah. Assuming normal looks similar.
Yeah, absolutely. So, in fact, statistically, when you do the statistical test, there's no difference between the SIBs and the typical controls. But it's the autism sample that actually is significantly disconnected. So again, this is that long-range connectivity that has appeared successfully in the SIBs, even though they have local regional abnormalities. But has not appeared in the people with autism. So, and in fact, we can look at measures of dimensional autistic traits, and these traits actually, levels of these traits actually correlate with the degree of temporal delay in this activation curve. So those unaffected siblings who have more delayed activation curves have more autistic personality traits than those that have less delayed curves. But SIBs as a group, there are long-range connectivities, but perfectly okay. Well, what kind of cognition? What kind of cognition does all of this lead to? How am I for time?
I haven't paid attention.
I get the benefit of the doubt, then.
Yeah, the benefit of the doubt. No, we have about.
Okay. All right. Okay, so what kind of brain does this kind of disconnectivity lead to? Imagine that your life is a film. And it's being projected in some sort of Cartesian cinema. Trouble is, the projectionist is less than fully competent. And perhaps he or she gets the aperture wrong, so you can see only a tiny corner of the picture at a time. Or perhaps you have sound without picture, or picture without sound. Or in general, you know, you can perceive only one channel of this Cartesian film. Now, of course, everybody around you is talking about this film, and you'd really, really like to understand what it's about. If the projectionist is a friend of yours, and you have ad libitum access to the Cartesian cinema, What might you ask your friend the projectionist to do? Sorry?
Do one after the other.
How do you mean one after the other?
One channel and the next.
Okay, right. So play the picture, then the sound, or yeah, sure.
Try to integrate.
Try to, well, can that be done by the projectionist, or does it have to be done by you? What you could ask is play it along the lines of what you're asking. Yeah, play it again. Maybe I can get something more out of it. Maybe I can attend to the other channels if I can just see it again. And this gets into the autistic preference for scripts and rituals. Now it's interesting, you know, I have actually reviewed papers where people go looking for the, we're using fMRI, we're searching for the brain region that's responsible for repetitive behavior in autism. Well, in fact, my claim is that such studies are fundamentally misdirected because repetitive behaviors in autism, at least complex repetitive behaviors, scripts and rituals, are actually accommodative strategies. They are what you do if you are a human being who has a disconnected brain that can perceive only one channel at a time. You try to constrain the world so that it's repeatable, so that you can rewind the film in the Cartesian cinema and play it again. It's an accommodative, adaptive strategy. And when you remove that crutch, when you try to have zero repetitive behaviors out of a person with autism, you can create a huge amount of anxiety and a difficulty coping. Obviously, one doesn't want to spend all one's time in repetitive behaviors, but one does want to spend some of one's time. And in fact, we all do this. Whenever we perform a ritual, whether it's, you know, eating the same thing for breakfast, brushing one's teeth in the same way every morning, going to a wedding and, you know, hearing the same line said, going to church on Sunday, you know, hearing the same, hearing the Lord's Prayer, whatever it is. These are all rituals that remind us of things that we're doing, that place us into a certain cognitive state. And we have to engage in these rituals because we are finite and limited creatures trying to understand an infinite universe, and therefore we have to script it. The only difference in autism is that the scripts are much, much more pervasive and tend to be about more concrete things. This is my favorite quotation from a person with autism. This is from from the St. John's Autism mailing list. I don't know if any of you are on that, or even if it still exists. I haven't been on it in years. But this person wrote in 1994, it's just that putting myself in someone else's shoes means that I first have to force that person out of their own shoes. Well, let's think a bit about what this means. Now, he actually did mean this metaphorically. He wasn't, you know, talking about, you know, he got the idea of what it means to be in someone else's shoes, right? The trouble with social perspective taking is that you need to do a couple of things. You need to be able to take the other person's perspective, but you also need to be able to suppress your own perspective. You are watching me standing up here, and the knowledge that I am the one standing up here and you are the one sitting out there interferes with your ability to imagine yourselves standing up here giving a lecture. Now, you can do it, you can override that, but the ability to do that override depends upon this ability to maintain two, or in general many, separate representations, each with integrated access to the central executive. And if you have a brain that can do one thing at a time, and only one thing at a time, you can't do this. You can do one, you can do the other. You could imagine yourself in someone else's shoes, but then again, you can't. You would have to turf that person out of their own shoes. The social psychologist Jakob Troppe describes this as one form of what he calls psychological distance. And social perspective taking, he connects to temporal perspective taking, imagining things at another time in the past or future. Spatial perspective taking and counterfactual perspective taking. What if? Not very good on that imitation task at the beginning, were we? Well, This also manifests, of course, in literary criticism. And many, many authors and critics have observed on this. My particular favorite one is Lacan's observation, le symbole se manifeste d'abord comme meurtre de la chose. The symbol manifests, firstly, as the killing of the thing. Right, well, what are we doing when we represent information, when we represent information? Tomorrow, I'm going to remember that I gave this lecture. I'm going to remember that it was in a classroom. I'm going to remember that there was a projector, there was a desk, there were some tables and chairs. I might not remember what color the chairs were. I certainly will not remember how many fluorescent lights were on the ceiling. I certainly will not remember how many cameras the faceless Big Brother was gazing at me from up on the ceiling. All these little details, right? I'm not going to remember them. And that's useful, because I don't need to remember all that stuff. None of it is what I need. I can place this classroom in my abstract category of classrooms. I can replace this classroom with an instance of my category of classrooms. That's useful to me because I have a finite brain, and I'm trying to use that finite brain to comprehend an infinite universe. So I project the infinite universe into a smaller number of categories, which I then can manage. But notice that that's a sacrifice that I'm making. I've lost the actual room, and I've replaced it with a memory, with an instance of a category. As Lacan observed, that's a sort of violence that one commits whenever one constructs a narrative representation. And I think that it's useful to conceptualize autism as a group of people that fall on the other side of that balance. So the trouble is constructing abstract categories, but they have a great ability to maintain veridical detail because of the kinds of brains that they have. Okay. I'm going to speed through the rest of this. What does all this mean for therapy? This was the state of the art in 1965, not exactly what you would call child-centered, much more therapist-centered. Today we're going to learn about pencil. You don't like pencil? Tough. Pencil. Let me ask you, we have 5 minutes, right?
Well, yeah.
Okay, very good. All right, so here's a child with autism. What is this child interested in? Yeah, the why. Okay. Now, it's often said that children with autism are not interested in the world around them, but I hope you can tell that images like this give the lie to that expression. This child is extremely interested in the wire, and what he's doing is he's manipulating it. He's giving it a certain amount of torque, he's twisting it, right? And he's observing the visual input, the feedback that comes from that motor manipulation. And there's a parametric relationship that he is deriving between the amount of twist that he gives the wire and the visual angle through which the wire is deflected. Now, this child is doing what we want every child to do, right? He's behaving as a scientist. He's learning about his world. He's experimenting on it. But too often what we say is, isn't it terrible? He's just completely uninterested in the world around him. That's because he's not interested in the parts of the world that we think he should be interested in. All these nice toys and the person behind the camera and so on and so forth, right? Point is, we can exploit this. If we can make the focus of joint social interaction, something that is of interest, a process or an object that is of interest to the person with autism, then we can open up education. Okay. Communication methods, a lot of them work by slowing down communication and reducing the demand for rapid integration or synchrony. So picture exchange, signing, this kind of thing. Again, so that it isn't necessary to do two things simultaneously. You can focus on the thought, or you can focus on the communicative act. And if you have to do those simultaneously by speaking, everything falls apart. What if you can do it by pointing at a picture or pointing at a series of letters? So here's the therapy where we have been studying, actually. This is called a rapid prompting method. And in the interest of time, I'll kind of speed through it. But starts with two alternative force choice. You take a piece of paper, you tear it in half, you write on one red, the other blue. You tell the person with autism, look, I know you're smart, and I'm not trying to test your intelligence, but we're just practicing communicating. Can you tell me if the sky is red or blue? Just point to one or the other. And all the person with autism has to do is, you know, flail to one side of space or the other. We build up from these two alternative force choice, right, to eventually to 26 alternative force choice, to the point where the child is able to sequentially point at letters. And these children, you know, they'll be pointing at letters. Now, this is not facilitated communication with the hand-over-hand stuff. This is independent pointing. And they'll point, they'll be in the middle of a word, they'll be sitting down, they'll get up, they'll twirl, they'll hand flap, maybe they'll run to the refrigerator, come back, sit down, start typing a word again. The important thing about that is it's asynchronous. You couldn't do that if you were speaking. You couldn't do that between phonemes. So the asynchrony is an important characteristic. Now, we've found that this method decreases repetitive behaviors, even though repetitive behaviors are not something that it targets. It increases the frequency and complexity of communications. Interestingly enough, in some but not all people, overt gaze decreases communicative complexity. Now think of that in terms of simultaneous processing. If I ask you to think about something and to look at something at the same time, it's really difficult. And when you think about it, we all do this. We all avert gaze when thinking and looking simultaneously are difficult for us. If you ask me a deep question, I'll say to you, well, let me think about that, and I'll avert my gaze, right? This is what the children with autism are doing. Now, this is very, very significant for therapy, because what's the first thing that a lot of behavioral therapists for autism do? Look at me, look at me, and the if the child can tolerate that, great, absolutely. It's the best thing for a lot of children. For those who can't do that integration, the child is like, very difficult. Okay, I will end up by saying that this actually generalizes, I think, beyond autism. You have autism shading into Asperger's syndrome and the broader autism phenotype, and a lot of these people communicate much, much more effectively using asynchronous media, like internet chat rooms, than they do using face-to-face conversation. And I think we can explain this as a spectrum of psychological distance and neural connectivity. Okay, so I'll fast forward from that to just some,
We're missing such a lot.
Yeah, sorry.
We're missing lunch in a minute.
To some acknowledgments. So this is my old lab at Cornell. And because we cannot get into the same photograph together ever, here's the other slide of the other people who didn't make it into the photo at Cornell. Cornell is a frozen wasteland for half the year, unfortunately, as you can see here. So I decided to leave to go to a place that was not a frozen wasteland. This is the group in Delhi. Nandini Singh, who has been my kind host for this past year. This is the group in Kolkata. So I will stop there. Thanks for
coming.
Probably don't have time for questions, I'm guessing.
Wow. I'm going to give at least one here with Stephen, because I do want to get you at least some feedback, and then I do think we should get lunch, otherwise we will be sorry in the afternoon.
Wonderful presentation, thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of my things is that language is coordination, so obviously I'm gassed about someone taking a similar view. But there's one thing that I sort of hear a double message in this that probably disturbs me sometimes. On the one hand, you focus very clearly on questions of timing and coordination. Mm. One of the messages I hear is that that is right at the heart of the story, especially this short time scale down, let's say, below half a second, probably well below that. Mm. On the other hand, I hear you talking about channels in a very broad-Bentian sort of way. Now, do you really want to bring those two things together?
That's an interesting question, and it's one that I ask myself a lot. the way that I am conceiving it
And this may actually be true, or it may be a limitation of my own cognition onto which I'm projecting things. But the way that I'm conceiving it is that if you have a collection of largely autonomous subprocessors, then it takes top-down, sort of frontal lobe-based coordination to reconfigure those subprocessors rapidly into a configuration that is appropriate for a new sudden problem demand. And it also takes top-down coordination in order to integrate information from those subprocessors into a single coherent whole. So that is the link that I claim. Now, that is more a philosophical characterization at this point than any sort of experimentally based inference.
But it's very interesting.
Any further questions? You can grab him at lunch so you can show him and get connected.
Don't you want to push yourself out of your own shoes?